This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Early voters are turning out in record numbers to cast a ballot in this historic election. How will the presidential candidate's last-minute media blitz affect the polls on Tuesday? Our Reporters Roundtable is going to take a look at these topics and more in a few minutes, but first we're going to look at the news affecting the media industry itself. This week, newspapers and magazines across the country were hit again with massive layoffs. The Christian Science Monitor announced this week that after a century, it would stop publishing a daily print paper. Joining us to talk about the cuts is Neil Henry. He's the dean of UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and the author of American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you.
So I'm not exactly the newest babe on the media block. I have worked in print for Newsweek and, you know, on air for television, off air, blah, blah, blah. And it just it hurts me. I have to say it really hurts me to hear about these incredibly steep cuts. You know, Time Incorporated saying 600 jobs, Gannett laying off people. I mean, the LA Times. Aside from the personal journalism pity party, what is this doing at a time like this election?
I gave a talk not long ago, actually, in Europe to a consortium of students at journalism schools in Denmark. A point I made was that one thing that the people in Europe might not understand is the severe contraction in the American news industry. An untold story of coverage of this particular campaign, that there are fewer and fewer organizations involved in actually covering it and fewer reporters due to the industry's contraction. And it's a hard thing to get outsiders to appreciate how important and significant a trend like this is, because we don't know the stories that aren't being covered.
Let's take a look at how information is moving from one medium to another. You have something like the Christian Science Monitor, and it's migrating to the web for most of its editions. What are the pros and cons of a move like that?
You save a lot of money because you don't put it out in hard copy as they have for many years. And another advantage is that you're trying to attract audiences who are gravitating to the web and digital media and by the millions. The question is whether people will actually go to a place like the Monitor for journalistic content. And this is the very struggle that every news organization that's attempting the transition is trying to make. You know, we talk about the personal repercussions of this. I was with the Washington Post for 17 years and came of age at a time when newsrooms were really opening to all kinds of different people, African Americans, Latinos, Asians. I came of age and my career at there ended back in the early 90s. And I visited there just a few months ago. And I can't tell you how heartbreaking it was to see all of these people, sort of my generation, who were at the top of their game, struggling with the issue of buyouts because they had become too expensive. I mean, their talent is the best in the country, but they had to take buyouts in order for the corporation to survive. What happens to these people? Well, they use the money and maybe go into other fields like academia. Perhaps they go into public relations. Perhaps they start with blogging or other developments on the web. But what we've lost is very difficult to recoup. I mean, you're talking like a whole generation of training.
Let's talk about race. The LA Times, again, saw more editorial staff cuts, and John Mitchell, who's a Metro reporter, was one of those let go. He wrote this in his farewell email to his colleagues, and it was published on the website LA Observed. So he wrote, "As this phase of my life comes to a close, my good fortune is tempered by a troubling reality. I am the only African-American male on a Metro staff responsible for covering the most diverse city in the nation. There are no blacks in foreign," meaning the foreign desk, "and at a time when the nation may elect the first African-American president, there are none on the national staff." What does that say about where we are as not just an industry, but also many people consider journalism one of the organs of democracy?
Yeah, well, it's pretty ironic, isn't it, that we live in an age of dazzling communications possibilities and extraordinary ways to inform the public. Yet the people who I believe are responsible for providing the most important, meaningful, trustworthy, credible information are the ones that are losing their positions. It's also particularly ironic that this heartfelt statement was made by the reporter at the Times, because it was the Times back in 1965 that was played a role in the changes in the American newsrooms that had occurred after the riots in the inner cities in the late 60s. Back in 1965, when the Watts riots broke out, the reporters and editors at the Los Angeles Times tried to cover it, and they looked around the newsroom, and they didn't see a single African-American reporter on staff. So they went down to the press room, found a guy named Bob Richardson, who was a printer, sent him out to Watts to cover it, and he phoned in reports from the scene. He was instrumental in the Times that year winning a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage. And it was after the Kerner Commission came out with its report in 1968, looking at the great divide among the races in American society, that pointed to the American news media in particular that needed to do a better job in covering the great diversity of American society.
What are the upsides? What are the upsides for journalism as it evolves? Because it has to evolve.
The upside are the incredible access you have to audiences now. Anybody in this age can be a publisher, a writer, a communicator. And there are tremendous possibilities.
Well, Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Neil Henry is the dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and the author of American Carnival, Journalism Under Siege in an Age of New Media. He joined us from the studios at the Journalism School. And now we're going to take a look at more of the week's news with Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and Jerome Vaughn, the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, folks.
Hi there.
Hey, good to be with you.
So let's talk a little bit about infomercials, and I'm not talking about Ginsu knives. I'm talking about the presidency. The Nielsen television ratings show that more than 33.5 million people tuned in to watch Obama's 30-minute paid segment on Wednesday. Let's listen to a bit.
We've seen over the last 8 years how decisions by a president can have a profound effect on the course of history and on American lives. But much that's wrong in our country goes back even farther than that. We've been talking about the same problems for decades, and nothing is ever done to solve them. This election's a defining moment.
Jerome, how do you rate this, not on politics, but on production values?
It was truly a beautiful thing. I mean, it was really hard to imagine in many ways that, you know, we're talking about this as an infomercial, but I mean, you know, in places the music swelled and the photography was gorgeous. And it was actually very interesting. It wasn't anything like, you know, back in the day you used to see infomercials for Flobies to, you know, cut your hair and things like that. It was quite engaging. And I think because of that, it really had an effect. I mean, that's why so many people watched it the other night.
It wasn't cheap either. We should say that from what we know, the infomercial ad buy, just the time alone, is estimated to have cost $5 million. And the commercial itself, producing it, cost somewhere between $3 and $5 million. Now, that's a small part of just the $150 million that the Obama campaign raised in September alone. But it's raising another question, Corey, which is public financing. Here's what Senator McCain said about Obama's huge coffers to CNN's Larry King.
That he signed a piece of paper back when he was a long shot candidate, and he signed it. Said, I will take public financing for the presidential campaign if John McCain will. I mean, that's a living document. He didn't tell the American people the truth.
Is this something that he, meaning Senator Obama, made a tactical or ethical violation about in terms of saying he was going to take public financing, but then realizing he may well be the best financer in the whole country in terms of raising political money and saying, actually, that's not really my plan?
Well, I think I obviously can't speak for him, but if along the lines of ethics, you know, did he lie? Well, I don't think anyone has really proven that he actually lied. He may have had every intention to take that money, take the public financing then. But as well we know, you know, any candidate has the prerogative to change their mind. I think the question is, would McCain be raising this if, in fact, the money was not helping Obama hold his lead over McCain? That's sort of the issue. And so at the end of the day, you know, McCain has a different end game to asking the question. I think the thing to keep in mind is that, considering the kind of campaign that Obama has run, he actually needed this money for it. This is about the most expensive campaign you can imagine because he had to come from so far behind. He had to literally build an infrastructure himself. If he had taken public financing, he wouldn't have been able to do that.
Corey, let me stay with you and talk about how voters are seeing their part in the process. Millions of people are actually going to the polls early, and you've been covering both Georgia and North Carolina. North Carolina is a traditional Republican stronghold, so how is that state playing out both in terms of early voting and overall in the polls?
Well, I'm actually here right now in North Carolina doing some reporting on the Senate race and the turnout so far. Just yesterday, the election board here in North Carolina decided to extend the voting hours of early voting on Saturday until 5 p.m. There are two specific heavily populated counties in Carolina who raised the request, and they acted on it. And the unique thing that North Carolina has going is sort of a one-stop shop where you can essentially register and vote on the same day. And that has brought voters out of the woodworks. And at this point, we're talking about, you know, a state that obviously wasn't in play before. But at this point, you know, we're talking about turnouts, you know, where you may have as many as, you know, at this point, perhaps 100,000 new voters who have turned out so far. And, you know, why? Well, obviously, you know, the competitiveness of the campaign in the state. But what's happened here in North Carolina also is that it has experienced sort of dramatic demographic changes since 1990, with sort of the economy down here changing into a more IT, high-tech job force that requires workers from other parts of the country coming here. And so what's happened in Virginia that has changed the dynamics there has also happened in North Carolina, with North Carolina a little bit further behind in that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so the voting attitudes are changing, quite frankly, and becoming more moderate.
All right, Jerome, I want to take you in another direction, which is to take what Corey just said about this unprecedented flow of voters to the polls and put it in the context of people who are non-traditional voters, people who, you know, the people who are least likely to vote are people who are poorly educated and don't make a lot of money. And so there's been a lot of effort to get and also younger, to get these non-traditional voters to the polls. So earlier this month, we spoke to Def Jam Records founder Russell Simmons about the work he's doing to get out the vote. He's also working with GlobalGrind.com, and let's listen to what he had to say about the Countdown to Change initiative.
It's about getting young people engaged in the process. It's these hip-hop kids and what they want to see happen and how they not only perceive it but work towards it, and it's kind of it's an aggressive move to connect all of these movements to make that difference on November 4th.
Again, the group that he's running as a business, GlobalGrind.com, is running a Countdown to Change, and it's a social networking site that's aimed at younger urban Americans. Since youth could make a huge difference in this election, what's going to reach them? What do you think, Jerome? Is it online social networking? Is it door-to-door? What do you think is going to make a difference?
I think it's a matter of the combination of all of them. I mean, I know that's the easy out for the answer, but, you know, they're talking to each other face-to-face about these things. I work here, you know, on the edge of a college campus, and you see Obama T-shirts all over the place. You see stickers, bumper stickers, lawn signs, all the old form stuff. But, you know, people are texting each other. They're watching the infomercial. I mean, it is every form of media that people are getting involved in, and young people especially are getting involved in. And I want to say the other thing, you know, along that line is this is all about Obama. And that's not to say all of the young people are going to vote for him necessarily, but he's the one that's brought this change to the process that's energized people. You know, 4 years ago with, you know, President Bush and John Kerry, we didn't see all this energy in the youth. It's about Obama and what he brings to the table. And especially with the urban youth, that's why they're really excited about it.
Corey, does that make it hard to cover the campaign fairly? Because, for example, you can say, well, I want to cover equal sides of A and B. But if B is not much of a factor, if, for example, there are not as many youth-oriented organizations that are McCain-affiliated organizations, how does that complicate the job of the journalist?
Well, I think journalists are sort of, predisposed to looking for balance. And I know, and I've just had this conversation with a Republican yesterday, that the media is biased toward more favorable coverage for Obama. And my response to him is that Obama has run, for all intents and purposes, a very media-centric campaign, which means that for a long time during the primaries, when he was ready to announce any big policy decision, when he was holding events, a lot of them were calibrated and scheduled and arranged in big markets where he could get TV coverage at certain times of the day when he wouldn't have to compete with other news broadcasts. And so as a result, he learned how to manipulate the media better. I think going forward, though, through the campaign, I think the challenge for journalists and news organizations is to, counter with something else. And so in this case, you don't look to cover McCain's impact with young people per se. You look to cover McCain's impact wherever he's having the greatest impact. So in many cases, it's rural America. In many cases, it's more conservative communities, older citizens. And that's where you balance it out.
Jerome, quickly, what do you think folks in our business should be doing in the final couple days of this campaign?
Well, I think they should be getting some sleep this weekend if they can manage it. After that, I think, I think a lot of us are going to be looking for, is there something that is unusual, that's out of the ordinary? I mean, both McCain and Obama, they're going to be giving their stump speech. They're going to be out there talking to as many people as they can. Is there going to be a new last-minute message? Is there going to be a new last-minute development? I think that's really what we're going to be looking for in the next couple of days.
All right, gentlemen, we will be all in this together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking to Jerome Vaughn, news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, he joined us from their studios, plus Corey Dade, the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal.